Chapter 3. The Sorrow of the Forest Spirits. On the drive to Kampong Sam, we'd expected potholes and bandits. Instead, we got the magnificent Road 4. Built with American money 2 years before, it unfurled like a black satin ribbon for 250 kilometers from Phnom Penh directly to our destination. Apparently, the authors of Gary's risk assessment report had not yet learned of it. "Good road," I said to Sun Hyun. "Not a good road," he corrected, "the best road." Yet, though our way was smoothed by American asphalt, our safety was still not assured. For this, we were told, we must stop at the shrine at Pitchnell Mountain. Our new companion, Heng Kenche, a tall, slender tiger specialist on Sun Hyun's staff, had journeyed this route to the Elephant and Cardamom Mountains many times before. He assured us this was an important stop. Clearly, other travelers agreed. At least 25 cars, plus a number of bicycles and motorcycles, were already parked beside the series of small shrines that stretched for 100 yards along the side of the road. Most were small pagodas the size of dollhouses. Each sat on a pedestal, its pitched, tiled roof curling up to the sky. The largest, though, was as big as a suburban garage and built on a base of brick. It housed the life-sized image of a blue-skinned woman robed in yellow silk and wearing a red towel on her head. The image, Kimche tells us, of Yamau. "Yamau married a husband," Kimche says with Sun Hyun's translation help, "but he left her for another girl. Yamau is pregnant. She crosses the sea looking for the husband, but the waves break the boat. As she is dying, she says, 'My blood sprays out in all directions.'" Her blood, the price of a promise broken, still drenches these coasts. The land is stained forever with betrayal. Only with her blessings can we safely pass. Sun Hyun buys each of us 3 sticks of incense to offer as we kneel before Yamau. Her shrine has been sumptuously appointed. It's crowded with colorful silk banners and garlands of peppery-smelling marigolds. Bowls overflow at her feet with offerings of money, fresh-baked sweets, polished rice, and fragrant fruits, hands of tiny sweet bananas, aubergine globes of mangosteen which smell like apples, starbursts of crimson hairy rambutan whose slippery opalescent flesh tastes like lychee. Yamau, once spurned, is now adored with earthly pleasures. Someone has even given her a cigarette, still smoking in between the red-painted lips of her clay mouth. As trucks and cars whiz past us on the magnificent Road 4, we kneel and pray silently to her spirit. The scent of incense rises in the hot mid-morning air, our prayers riding on its smoke like words on a song. As we drove on toward the goal of our scientific expedition, we spoke of gods and ghosts. How did Kimche come to know the story of Yamau? He said it was told to the old people by her ghost, speaking through a medium. The dead are not silent in Cambodia. Ancestral spirits called Thich Nhat inhabit certain hills, trees, and mounds, and must be propitiated with offerings, lest they cause sickness, flood, or drought. Even on city sidewalks, often you'll see a banana, some flowers, cup of wine, or sticks of incense someone has left for the Thich Nhat. Like the living, the dead can be fearsome or kind. Some spirits make babies cry. Some wake you up and warn you of disaster. Some, the mischievous spirits of young Buddhist acolytes, hang around temples and cause the faithful to trip. Some spirits are such welcomed guests that their human relatives are honored to host the visitor in their own bodies. In this way, Sun Hyun told us, his grandparents often visit the family, choosing to speak through their daughter. "When my grandmother used my mother to say something, the behavior is quite different," Sun Hyun reported. "For instance, his mother doesn't smoke, but when his grandmother inhabits her body, she enjoys cigarettes without coughing. When his grandmother uses his mother's body to speak, his mother puts on lipstick, just like her mother did, although she seldom wears it herself. When the grandmother visits this way, she sometimes reveals news that the mother does not know," Sun Hyun told us. "She says to my brother, 'You have a girlfriend. and he has a girlfriend. Or, be careful, you're going to have a big accident, and the next month you have a big accident. For some years, especially since he began his scientific training, Sun Yin has tested the efficacy of prayers and prophecies like a pharmaceutical company might test a new drug. Sometimes they do appear to work. He told us about the time his cousin, an unusually tall and handsome fellow whom we would meet later, was traveling some years ago to Kampong Sam, where he now lives, in a taxi truck. He prayed at a shrine before the journey. He got into one taxi, but then something told him to choose another. The first car left immediately, while the second was delayed. He was annoyed with his decision. But when he finally made it to Kampong Sam, he discovered that the first car was attacked by Khmer Rouge insurgents. The passengers were murdered for their luggage. On the other hand, Sun Yin said, he's observed that the traditional beliefs are sometimes wrong, and traditional spiritual remedies do not always work. One guy close to my house was bitten by a cobra, he told us. Instead of getting the patient to the hospital for a shot of antivenom, a shaman was summoned to call the cobra to the scene. If the cobra can be convinced, according to traditional belief, the snake will take its poison back. I wait all day, said Sun Yin. I want to see the snake. But the person say, something is wrong with the spirit of the forest, so the cobra not come. A more famous shaman was then summoned, but still the snake did not return. The person died at the end of the day. Stupid, said Sun Yin. Sun Yin's parents tell him he has a guardian spirit watching over him. My parents encourage me to pray every night. I go to pagoda. I am Buddhist. I do not want to lose my culture. But in my mind, he said, I don't believe. Nonetheless, we all prayed at the shrine to Yamau. Even Gary, who, though raised Protestant, does not believe in gods or spirits or even, to my continuing and ill-concealed Christian dismay, in the historical veracity of Jesus' human existence. Science is God enough for him. Still, the professor admitted, when he learned 4 years ago that his father had cancer, he prayed. After chemotherapy, the cancer went into remission. It's good, I think, to play it safe, Gary told us. There's nothing to lose by praying if it might help, he said. Later, I was grateful for our prayers at the shrine. Sun Yin's snake shaman, as it turns out, was right. Something is wrong with the spirit of the forest. Shortly after our stop at Pichnil Mountain, we drove through the gates of Mong Rati's oil palm plantation. We had seen billboards advertising his venture along the road. Mong Rati Cambodia Oil Palm Investment Company Limited. Long before we approached the gate to the compound, we saw a sprawling company town of wooden houses on stilts adorned with blue metal roofs. Mong Rati must be like the Cartwrights in Bonanza, Gary said. The inner compound was surrounded by a sturdy gate. A uniformed guard with an AK-47 spoke brusquely with Sun Yin before he let us pass. What did you say to him? I said. He wants to know what party we are from, Sun Yin replied. The Free the Bears party, suggested Gary. Sun Yin allowed that was not the right answer. Within 100 yards, we came to a square metal cage, large as a courtyard and roofed in the same material as the workers' houses. Inside, among the feathery leaves of low-growing mimosas, was the beautiful creature we had come so far to see. Ah, cried Sun Yin. Yes, right there. She was more beautiful, more golden, and more fragile than we'd imagined. Her face was ghostly pale, like the moon's or an angel's, and framed by a dark, thick mane, black on the sides and gold on the top, where it shone like a halo. Except for the pale face and the dark at the mane and the edge of her ears, she was arrayed all in gold, gold of different hues, like a royal raiment a princess might wear. In fact, she was a captive princess. A sovereign stolen from her home realm, seized by an alien race for her very rarity and beauty. So was the radiant Sita, the incomparably beautiful wife of Princess Rama, kidnapped by the tin-headed king of demons in the greatest of the sacred Hindu epics, the Ramayana, scenes from which are depicted on every Buddhist temple's walls. The bear's gorgeous golden fur hung loosely on her frame. She was at least 1.5 years old, but weighed perhaps only 125 pounds, so thin we could see her ribs. Through Sun Yin, we learned from a guard she hadn't eaten for a week. Everything we learned about her caused us more distress. Earlier, we had heard she had a black male cage mate. Where was he? We had planned to pluck hair from him, too, for comparison with her DNA. But, we learned from the guard, 2 months ago he had severed his tongue. He had died within days. The golden bear's mate was dead, and now she was sick. In the Ramayana, Sita is ultimately rescued. Her freedom is won, in large part, thanks to the help of millions of animal warriors, monkeys called Vanars and bears called Balukas. In the folk epic, Prince Rama is also able to bring the animals who had died serving him in battle back to life. But Rama was a god on earth. To perform miracles was his dharma, his life's work, his destiny. Our dharma is of a different nature. We cannot free the golden bear or revive her mate, but Sun Yin, working to strengthen and enforce laws to protect animals like her, is perhaps Rama's human equivalent. And Gary, as a scientist, can bestow upon her a sort of immortality. She will be the first of her kind to be described by science, whether she turns out to be a color phase, a new species, or a new subspecies. And Gary's account in the scientific literature will outlive both her and us. Gary speaks his notes into the tape recorder. The snout is patchy grayish-white, the chin also perhaps just pure white. The mane is black, and all along the side of the neck down to the head and back of the ears is black, and it looks like it gets yellowish on the chest. It looks kind of reddish-yellow on the head, and the V on the chest is slightly lighter than the light yellow. A yellowish-black mixture of hairs, I would say, behind it, and the much deeper reddish-yellow hairs in front of it. Now Sun Yin reports an incredible stroke of luck. He has just met the very man who captured her, a security soldier who works for the plantation. From him, we can confirm precisely where she came from, and perhaps glean other details that will help us determine who and what she is. He tells us he was hunting nearby in Prey Nup district around 6:30 one evening in the rainy season of 1997 when he first saw her, a small golden cub, perhaps 10 kilograms or 22 pounds, running by herself across a recently cleared patch of land. At first he thought she was a forest pig. He'd never seen a bear like her. He came close, thinking to capture the cub as a gift for his boss. At one point, he feared the cub would bite him. He told us, without shame, that he then struck her so hard that he broke her teeth, bloodied an eye, and knocked her unconscious for 2 days. Did he ever see the mother bear? Gary wants to know. A black-haired moon bear with a golden youngster would answer our question immediately. The golden bear would have to be an unknown color phase, not a new species. But the mother, says the guard, was never seen. Has the bear changed color since her capture? Gary asks. There is no data on color change in moon bears, and very little on their likely closest relatives, American black bears. About 80% of American black bear cubs are born with a white patch on the chest, but many of these fade. Brown or cinnamon-colored American black bear cubs sometimes turn black or brown within 2 years. If the golden bear were growing darker with age, it would be a sign that her unusual color was a growth phase. But no, the guard answers, impossible. Has he ever heard of anyone else seeing golden bears? Well, said our informant, the well-guarded private compound doesn't get many visitors. But yes, he remembers once when people came from another part of the country. They said they had seen a bear like this before. Where were they from? Asked Gary. Kokang, said the answer. The huge province to the north, which encompassed the heart of the Cardamom Wilderness. When we finished our interview, Sun Hyun and I asked Gary what he made of this information. "I don't think it tells me one way or another," he answered. "It could be a very rare species of bear. It could be an occasional color morph. We really need to have the DNA information to tell." With some difficulty, we enticed the bear over to us with bananas, marshmallows, and sweetened condensed milk so that Sun Hyun, Kim Che, and I could take turns plucking hairs from her head. She loved the sweet milk. Sun Hyun, squatting close to her cage, withdrew the can to enlarge the opening for her. She grew impatient, and her head lunged out between the bars with astonishing speed. She snapped at his knee with a snarl. "If I get a scar," Sun Hyun said, "I show my professor in America. This is how the wildlife thinks about me." Miraculously, she'd not even broken his skin. But without hair from a black bear caught from the same area for comparison, the hairs we obtained from her would be irrelevant. "No problem," says Sun Hyun. "Many people have bear." We first visited the Lee Nam Hotel, one of the fanciest in Kampong Sam, built during the city's heyday as a seaside resort. Among its lush plantings and landscaped paths, the hotel has an impressive zoo with 20 spacious, green-painted steel cages housing a sleeping golden cat, 4 playful sun bears, colorful shrieking pheasants, several kinds of monkeys and gibbons, but no moon bear. Next, we spoke with the pregnant woman in the blue pantsuit at the market, only to learn she had just sold her moon bear that morning. We traveled a bit farther. We stopped at a fruit farm on a newly cleared piece of land planted with mango and jackfruit. Next to the owner's veranda, where you might expect to find a large shade tree with a spirit house beneath, we found instead a yellow bulldozer, its jaws caked with forest. We spoke with 8 of the farm laborers, gaunt, sinewy men with broken toenails and calloused feet. Yes, they said, they could tell us where to find a bear. One of their friends snared a bear right here in the forest, about 7 kilometers from where the Rong Rati bear was captured. He plans to sell it for much money, they said. For a day's work on a fruit farm, the men explained, a laborer can make 5,000 rials, about $1.37. But a wild pig caught from the forest, whose flesh is a delicacy, could bring 30,000 rials, a week's salary, at the market. A bear garners much more than that. Awaiting a buyer, the friend is keeping the bear at his forest camp in the mountains, not even a day's walk from here. But what kind of bear have they captured? A sun bear would be useless to us scientifically, but if it's a moon bear, we could not ask for a more perfect comparison with our second golden specimen. Animals of the same species who live far apart geographically are likely to have marked genetic differences. But if 2 from the same area show large genetic differences, this can reflect the wider, deeper separation of different species or subspecies. Discovering what kind of bear it is proves unexpectedly difficult. The Khmer word for bear, Sun Hyun explained to us, is Klak Moon, or honey-eating tiger. In traditional literature, the moon bear is called Klak Moon Tum, large honey-eating tiger. The smaller sun bear is Klak Moon Tok, small honey-eating tiger. In the province where Sun Hyun grew up, though, the people call the moon bear Klak Moon Chai, the honey-eating tiger like a dog, or dog bear, even though it looks less like a dog than the sun bear. The sun bear, however, is called the honey-eating tiger like a pig, Klak Moon Chuk, or pig bear. But our informants do not know these terms. They use a different word to describe this bear, Klak Moon Krabai, the honey-eating tiger like a buffalo. Sun Hyun gesticulates as he quizzes them on the buffalo bear's characteristics. Does it have large or small ears? Small ears, they say, like a sun bear. Does it have a short or shaggy coat? Shaggy, they answer, like a moon bear. Both species might be found in the elephant ranges. Which is it? Or is it a new bear species? Is it a bear at all? Many Southeast Asians consider the dark, fluffy, tree-dwelling binturong, closely related to civets and mongooses, as a kind of bear. In Thai, the binturong is called mi kor, or hook bear, for its grasping tail. In Guangdong, China, certain hunters consider the hog badger, which is a species of badger, not a hog, as a type of bear, naming it the dog bear. The Bamar of Burma call the red panda, which, unlike the giant panda, a true bear is thought to be related instead to raccoons, the cat-like bear, whereas the Binturong there is called the bear-like cat. In many languages, an animal goes by a name that suggests a false identity, like the American prairie dog, which is not a dog at all, but a stout, short-tailed, short-legged ground squirrel. Canadians used to call the wolverine the devil bear, although it's not a bear and certainly no devil. It is a huge, tree-dwelling weasel. "This thing could be anything," I say. "Including sold," says Gary. "There's only one way to find out. We hire one of the workers to take us to the forest camp the next day." At dawn, rain clouds hang over the Elephant Mountains like dragon's breath. We're eager to enter the forest, to immerse ourselves in a world teeming and unexplored. Besides sun and moon bears, there are thought to be more than 400 tigers and perhaps 300 elephants scattered among the cardamom and elephant ranges. Clouded leopards with fur soft as mist hide in the trees, waiting to spring on ground prey. Fishing cats with strange, non-retractable claws and webbed paws haunt shallow streams and scoop out fish. Rare red Asian wild dogs called dholes hunt in packs, whistling to keep the family together. Prey are diverse, from the sambar, at 700 pounds, southern Asia's largest deer, to wild boar and muntjac, to the tiny chevrotain, a mouse deer that grows just over a foot long and can weigh as little as 3 pounds. Rarer hoofed animals can be found here too, including two, perhaps three, kinds of white-stockinged wild ox. The gore, huge and hump-shouldered, the bantang, whose dark coat gleams almost blue, and possibly the even rarer cuprey. In interviews with hunters, Kim Che reported some of them claim the presence of an even more exotic hoofed animal, the Kating Vor. Sun Yan had told us about it when we'd visited him in Minnesota. No museum has ever acquired its corpse, skin, skull, or photograph. It's known to science only for its unique annulated horns. But the horns alone were evidence enough for biologists in 1994 to bestow on it a scientific name, Pseudonovibos spiralis, and to classify the unseen creature as a new type of wild goat. American collectors obtained the first horns known to science from Vietnam in 1929, but the specimens were misclassified as the horns of a female cuprey. The cuprey is now thought extinct in Vietnam, and there hunters may have exterminated the Kating Vor too. But the creature, Sun Yin believed, might well have found refuge in Cambodia. The local people, they say they know this animal, Sun Yin had told us. 8 of 31 hunters Kim Che interviewed in the Elephant and Cardamom Mountains said they had seen it. Indeed, one man said he had seen one in 1998, a buffalo-like animal with black or gray pelage, weighing perhaps 660 pounds, but capable of leaping like a goat. What else is known of this enigmatic animal? Sun Hien told us what the people say, that the beast uses its horns to spear poisonous snakes, which it eats, that the snakes, attempting escape, may coil onto the horns, and that in so doing the serpents carve the characteristic ring-like spiraling ridges and leave the horns imbued with a powerful antidote to snake venom. For this reason, the animal has two Khmer names, Kating Vor, wild cow with horns like lianas, as well as Kating Si Pu, the wild cow who eats snakes. "Maybe we make another expedition, search for Kating Vor," Sun Yin had suggested. As we set out that morning, we all fantasized about seeing one, even getting a photograph. Kim Che mentioned that tigers in these forests are known to kill people in chance encounters, and told us to watch out for cobras. We began our journey along a track as wide as a suburban American house, the yellowish soil corrugated with the metal tread of earth-moving equipment. Sun Hien clucked his disapproval. This track had not been here when he last visited 2 years before. Elephants used to cross the road here, he said. He reckoned that elephants might soon be gone from the mountains that bear their name. The track ran through a wasteland of charred stumps and blackened earth. The destruction did not abate for miles. We followed our ragged guide, a hunter wearing flip-flops, who had known the forest that once stood here quite well. He was a friend of the worker we'd met at the farm the day before, who had also joined us, bringing up the rear. The plantation worker carried a machete to clear our path through the jungle. It seemed absurdly unnecessary. Finally, after an hour or so, we could see the raped land struggling to reclothe itself in green. Loggers had cleared this portion of the land perhaps 15 years ago, and now small saplings, scrub, and lianas scrambled toward the light. Actually, Sun Hyun told us, degraded forest like this often makes excellent habitat for bears. Some of the early plants that recolonize a logged area are berry-bearing brambles. Fire-hollowed trees make excellent nests for tasty bees, ants, termites, and their high-fat larvae. All of these are foods bears love. Perhaps, in addition to solving the mystery of the captive cub, we might see signs of wild bears today, he said. Claw marks on trees, holes clawed in the dirt, and the platform-like nests that bears make in tree branches as they feed on nuts and fruits. Cricket song rose around us like heat exhaled from the earth. The track became more muddy until we came to a knee-deep stream. Sun Hyun was not pleased. Water, he lamented, letting the word go reluctantly like a sigh. Many leeches, maybe. I hoped not. I'd encountered many of these while working on a book in Borneo several years back. One of the more unwelcome discoveries of my literary career was plucking one of these black, slug-shaped parasites bloated with my blood out of my bra. Gary had no such prejudices. When he was a graduate student taking a field course in Costa Rica, he had graciously hosted a parasitic maggot in his flesh. He named it George. George's mother had glued her egg to a female mosquito, who had then bitten Gary on the back of his upper left arm. Warmed by his skin, the egg had hatched immediately, and George had burrowed into his skin. Soon the bot created an itchy swelling as big around as a nickel, from the center of which George would periodically poke out a snorkel-like breathing tube. Gary observed his parasite with interest until it grew to the size of a lawn grub and, unfortunately, died. "You put the leg in the water and leeches are coming," Sun Hyun tells us dejectedly as we cross the stream. Leeches locate their prey by sensing body heat, but if any have found us, we won't know until later. Their saliva contains both a natural anesthetic and an anticoagulant, so the first sign of a bite is often blood soaking from a painless wound. Soddenly, we mount a small rise. Fat white geese, which many people keep as watchdogs or doorbells, herald our arrival with deafening honks. We have reached the hunter's camp. Beneath a tin roof held aloft by log pillars, we find two little wire cages. One, on the ground, houses a miserable muntjac. In the other, raised above the ground in blocks of wood, is a small black bear with tall, rounded ears and a white chin. "Oh, yes!" cries Sun Hyun in delight. "Asiatic black bear! We have our comparison bear." She's about the size of a cocker spaniel, perhaps a year old, Sun Hyun says. She has a white triangular chin patch and a white V on her chest. She seems dazed with terror. She's been here for many weeks. A ring of naked skin around her neck testifies that not long ago she was held captive by a collar or chain. We offer her a treat of sugar cane, which she shyly accepts. She doesn't seem to mind when we pluck her hair. For her, life is boredom punctuated only by food and fear. Summoned by the geese, one of her captors appears. Attempting to be gracious to his visitors, he opens the door of her tiny cage to display his prize. Seeing him, her fan-shaped ears slam back like an uncertain dog. As he shouts at her, brandishing a stick, she steps forward gingerly, as if her footsteps hurt her. She's clearly been hit before. She does not know what he wants. At her first opportunity, she hurries back into the horrid little cage. Why is he keeping her captive here? What does he propose to do with her? Sun Yin asks at our request. The man answers, improbably, that he plans to start a zoo. We doubt it. All of us wish desperately that we could rescue her. We could certainly buy her, like many of the captive bears we've seen. But then what? The National Zoo outside Phnom Penh is already full of moon bears and can accept no more. Let her go? Baby bears cannot survive in the forest without their mothers any better than a baby human could. Older bears loosed in new territories would likely die also. Wild females, in their second spring of life, share their range with their mothers and sisters. Other bears are driven away. Young male bears must establish new territories, wandering sometimes for hundreds of miles to find them, running a gauntlet of older established males, roads, dangerous terrain, and hunters' guns and snares. The little bear at the camp reminded me of the dilemma of the caged wild birds at many Buddhist temples. The pious purchase them to set them free, an act of kindness to make merit and improve one's lot in the next life. But the freed birds, weakened by their captivity, are almost always captured before the day is over, and again sold in order to make humans feel more noble by freeing them. We took away her hairs for science and left her behind in her prison. We continued to walk toward the forest, as if immersion in the wild lands where the little bear should have roamed free could cleanse our hearts. "Quick, quick, please!" Sun Yin called to us from up the trail. "Very large, very big!" Excitedly, we hurried toward him. Could it be a wild bear? A monkey? A muntjac? No. Our wildlife encounter lay on the mud beside Sun Yin's boot. At first, the creature appeared to be as long as a man's thumb. But then, sensing the heat of our bodies, it stretched towards Gary's foot. Green on the bottom, brown on the top, with a black stripe down the middle. It was a slippery, mucus-coated mussel as long as a banana, the most monstrous leech any of us had ever seen. Sun Yin, what's the matter? As we walk, Gary and I have been listening for the trills and chirps of unseen birds, the rumble of approaching thunder. But our Cambodian companions are holding an animated discussion. In the nasal sing-song of their voices, we hear deep concern. "Three people on the road," Sun Yin says. "Don't know who they are." We don't understand. "The guy with the red shirt," Sun Yin says, referring to our guide. "He was arrested a few months ago."
"Arrested?"
"He get hit, he have to pay 5,000 baht, and he's a worker, not a rich people, and he came with rich people who have a lot of money, and they were going to buy land here, and he was arrested in this area."
"They paid that money not to get arrested?" Gary asks.
"To be released," said Sun Yin. "Mixed together with Khmer Rouge are other people who will kill." Sun Yin, who is extremely brave, is clearly rattled by the news. Slowly, the garbled story begins to unfold. 2 months ago, as our guide was escorting some Cambodian land speculators through this very forest, he and his party were attacked by bandits. They were blindfolded, beaten with sticks, and held for days in the jungle for ransom. His family had paid the equivalent of $140, 4 months of a day laborer's salary, for his release. The families of his rich companions each paid 50,000 Thai baht, an astronomical $1,315. And now the guide is concerned, because he has spotted three strangers on the road into the forest. He's worried they might be bandits. Bandits in this area are well armed and also have radios to alert companions in deeper parts of the forest that good ransom bait might be coming their way. They could be lying in wait for us now. "With skin like us," says Sun Yin, "who will believe we have no money? We are targets." He means, of course, with skin like mine and Gary's. "At least we outnumber them," I note, trying to sound very calm. "Not necessarily," said Gary.
who's carrying all our cash in the front pocket of his cargo pants. We don't know how many there really are. I wish he had shared this with us before he took us into the forest, I say. Gary's wish is more practical. I wish we had a gun. If you have gun, they also have gun, said Sun Hyun. Long gun, strong gun. We walk along silently with our wheeling thoughts. The gallant Gary is trying to figure out how he will subdue the bandits and save us all. I am irrationally planning to convince the bandits to take just me but let the others go. Then I will somehow escape. Sun Hyun is pragmatic and resigned. Where, he asks, will Lena's parents get 50,000 baht? We see no other option than to continue on. Standing still, we're sitting ducks. To turn back now would take us to where our guide so recently saw the strangers. To go deeper into the forest at least affords us a chance to see bear habitat and bear sign. And besides, now it's raining, and the young trees are large enough to provide us some shelter. On the wide logging road, we'd be soaked. The decision feels right. To me, the forest means safety. In dreams, it's always to the forest that I run to escape the faceless human dangers of my fears. True, the forests of my dreams are always New England's, stately, ordered, cool, not the tangled, humid jungles of Southeast Asia. And it's true that no jungle is particularly safe. Part of the operatic majesty of the rainforest is its voluptuary dangers, its sweet poisons and hidden jaws. I discovered in Borneo that in Southeast Asia's jungles, fruits spiked like maces fall from trees and can kill you. A moment sitting on the wrong log can burn the skin black with toxic sap. Unseen, biting, stinging ants may erupt from holes in the ground. Venomous caterpillars can drop out of branches. Vipers might coil beneath your feet. But these are innocent cruelties. There is purity even in their menace. There is no greed, no duplicity in the cobra's bite. Only the humans were evil enough to be sent away from Eden. God, in his wisdom, let the snake stay. It's raining insistently now, making a sound as if all the souls in heaven and hell were whispering at once. But what are they telling us? What to do? Again, Sun Hyun's idea is practical. Let's eat lunch. Our guide leads us to a small platform beneath a thatched roof. Drawn by the smell of food, two yellow, ridge-backed hunting dogs appear from the wet gloom. I toss them a bit of rice. To my sorrow, they cower from my offering. Like the little bear, they've been hit before and expect humans to harm them. The dogs in the shelter belong to our guide. Gary and I ask how he hunts, and he shows us eagerly. He holds up a coil of wire, the circumference of a dinner plate, with two metal loops. One loop attaches to a flexed pole. The snare is set on the ground and covered with duff. When an animal trips the trap, the loop closes, the pole straightens, and the creature is hoisted up into the air by a leg, where it will hang until the hunter checks his snare. The hunter smiles broadly as he portrays these events with his gestures. What sorts of animals would he catch in this way? Kim Che translates for us. Pig, deer, barking deer. Some species in Cambodia are protected against hunting by local tradition. It's believed in certain areas that to kill an elephant, a wreathed hornbill, or the tiny, wide-eyed, slow loris brings bad luck to the hunter. To slaughter a fish eagle, which mates for life, causes divorce. Killing a tiger can bring depression or disease to wife and children. But these snares make no choices. They tighten around any hand or foot, paw or hoof that steps on them. And even if a large animal, like an adult bear, can break free, the loop will continue to tighten, wire chewing into flesh, slowly disabling the creature until it dies of gangrene. Primatologist Diane Fossey considered snares like this one the primary killers of the endangered mountain gorilla she studied in Rwanda. And although the crime is unsolved, many agree that her murder may well have been committed by one of the men who lived by setting such snares. Yet this is neither the most lethal way of hunting nor the most hideous. A report by Cat Action Treasury, authored by Sun Hyun's friend, the expat American Hunter Weiler, mentions animals in Cambodia are routinely hunted with machine guns. In Cambodia's Viel Veng district, farther north in the Cardamoms, the police chief told Hunter that Thai merchants were supplying hunter groups with high-velocity Magnum elephant guns with telescopic sights, capable of dropping an elephant at 500 meters for the illegal ivory trade. Tigers, whose bones are sold as medicine, are often killed by placing mines under monkey carcasses. In many areas, the illegal wildlife trade is supported by gangs of traders, widespread availability of guns, illegal logging, deforestation, which both makes the forest more accessible and the capture of wild animals easier, and an utter lack of law enforcement. All hunting, even for food, is illegal in Cambodia, but the absurd law is impossible to enforce, especially for cheap snares like these. They cost pennies to buy, can be set anywhere, and are so well hidden that even the animals can't find them. How many snares like this has our guide personally set in this forest? We ask through Kimche. How many are out there now? The answer, about 180, just by this one hunter. In this forest, there are certainly thousands. For its innocent residents, this Eden has become a hell. After lunch, we slog on through the mud. We hear nothing but the hissing rain, our sucking footsteps, and the zippery squeal of our nylon ponchos. We see little beyond the blinders of our hoods and the curtains of rain. Sun Hyun tells us there's little chance of finding sign of bears or anything else. Sensibly, the animals are hiding snug in thickets and holes or beneath logs or rocks. Their footprints have dissolved in the rain. So, reluctantly, we decide to turn back. Tomorrow, he suggests, we will take the ferry to Koh Kong and there venture into a much wilder area in the heart of the Cardamom Range. We never saw the strangers again. But on the way back, we heard an explosion in the direction from which we had just come. Thunder? I asked Gary. No, he said, and answering my unspoken question, neither was it the sound of a gun. What was that? We asked Kimche. He knew the sound well. He answered matter-of-factly, landmine.